Welcome to the discussion about capital, power, tech, and global crises, and how they intersect. And so, as we sit here, there are 100 million forced migrants around the world, that is refugees and internally displaced persons. There are about 300 million people that are starving, about 2.6 billion people who don't have internet, and about 2 billion people who don't have access to banking and finance. And this is just a sampler of a very long list of deprivations that are happening now in the world. And there are two narratives how these global crises can be solved. The main narrative says that it's the developed countries that will solve the problems and design the solutions. And then there is a second narrative, and that one says that it's the developing countries, the developing and emerging markets that will lead the way. I work for UNICEF's Office of Innovation, and we ascribe 120% to the second narrative. We work off three premises. The first one is that problem solvers from emerging and developing markets are the key element of this global architecture of problem solving. The second premise is that open tech is better than closed tech. And the third premise is that to solve global crises, you really have to reorganize how power and capital flow around the globe. And so with that, we as UNICEF have our own venture fund. It's called UNICEF Venture Fund. And we only fund startups, social impact startups, and tech entrepreneurs from countries where UNICEF has its country offices. That means it's most of the countries in the world, like all of the countries in the world, minus the EU, US, Canada, Korea, Japan, etc. We also only fund startups that develop in open source. To this date, we funded 81 startups from 37 countries with $7.3 million. All of it is equity free. And so the UNICEF Venture Fund is really the glue that brought together this panel. All of the panelists are recipients of UNICEF Venture Fund support. I will introduce them now. So for this discussion, you have one talking head that's here. And then there's a very clear line where the smart starts. So these are people who are super smart, who build stuff, who are young, and who actually have the lived experience of problems that they want to solve. And so with that, we have Antonella. Antonella is the COO of Xcapit. Xcapit is an Argentina-based company that builds blockchain-based products for financial inclusion. We have Kavi. Kavi is a founder, CEO, and head of product at Tilly. Tilly is a Sri Lanka-based company that uses machine learning and data to build and measure children's cognitive skills. And we have Christina. Christina is a co-founder and CTO of AQAI. It's an India-based company that uses AI to predict levels of air pollution and support for climate intelligence. And so, by the way, I want to see, so we introduce ourselves, but I would love to know who you are. So maybe if you can just quickly, I know everyone does it, but can you please raise your hand if you work at the intersection of social impact and technology? Awesome. Those who built a product or a platform, amazing. Those who give money to social impact, and cool. Those who directly work with what's called Global South, for better or worse. Okay, great, cool. Then I'm gonna start us off. I'm gonna start us off with Kavi, who I learned today that she's been drinking coffee since she was 3 years old. So she's very energized. She's gonna be the first one to answer our questions. So when we prepared for this session, We said that the objective for us should be twofold: to make the case for investing in the emerging and developing markets, but also to flesh out this disconnect where so little resources go into those geographies where so many of these global crises are. In the description of this panel, I think it says that 10% of global capital flows, venture flows, goes into the global south. It's actually 5%. And for instance, in continents like Africa, out of the 5%, 80% goes to only 4 countries. So if you're a social impact entrepreneur with the Lyft experience that's in Sierra Leone, then that's too bad. You won't get any support. And so, Kavi, can you describe what, first of all, if you can describe what Thiele is about, what you're working on, but also if you experience, if at all, this kind of lack of support. Has it been easy for you? Has it been difficult? Did you get a break? What's happening out there?
The fact that I've been drinking coffee since like 3 is true. It's not a reflection on my parents. I just wanted to put it out there. But it's really exciting to be in a room filled with people who are focused on impact. So thank you so much for coming here on the last day. There are so many other things you could have done today instead. To tell you very briefly about what we do and why we came into this work, if you look at statistics, 1 in every 3 children in the developing world, so in emerging markets, in low and middle income countries, do not reach critical developmental milestones by the age of 10. And what that means is, simply because of the place where a child was born, we're giving them a very poor start at life. And the reason why this matters is because 80% of our brain development is done by the age of 10. So by me saying that 1 out of every 3 children in countries like mine do not meet these milestones means that we're letting their zip code determine everything from mental health outcomes to financial success to job market failure simply because of where they were born. And this is exactly what we're trying to tackle. So we bring in data, machine learning, and play to measure and build 8 of the most foundational cognitive skills in children before they turn 10. What's been easy for us is bringing research and data to build learning products that actually lead to behavioral change. That's been easy. But what's been hard is finding donors and funders who are values aligned, who are patient, who will allow us to scale this work. And that's, I guess, what we're going to talk today. And I think that's been one of the hardest things, scaling. Because doing work in countries like ours, via bureaucracy, ability to pay is extremely low. We're dealing with situations where there is no Wi-Fi, no internet, sometimes no electricity in some of the schools where we work. So we've gotten very good at building products for communities like this. But finding donors who understand and speak our language has been hard. But I'll pause there.
Great, yeah, and I think this part where somebody is born, it's a good one to remember. Basically, it takes no genius to be born in Switzerland. I've always liked that phrase. And so it really is a bit of a coincidence what opportunities were given. Christina, over to you. If you can tell us a little bit about what AQAI is doing. And what's your experience been with getting or not getting the help that you need?
Yep. Hi, I'm Christina. I'm the CTO of AQAI. I'm also a postgraduate researcher at MIT. AQAI stands for Air Quality Artificial Intelligence. So it doesn't take a genius to figure out what we do. We try and predict air pollution using AI machine learning. What does that look like? Well, we're actually building models that tap into data from satellites. So that's everything that you can get from land use classification to hyperspectral imagery to these things called aerosol density. So that's actually figuring out how many kind of particulates there are in the column of air between, you know, the satellite in space and where you are on the ground. And then using sensors on the ground. So we have a network of 1,600 sensors that we use as our ground truth. And they're obviously, you know, dotted about the planet. But guess where? There's only 5 in the whole of the continent of Africa. And there's actually only around 250 centers in India, where we see the highest exposure levels of air pollution. So what we have is a very, very inadequate and inequitable distribution of these sensors, which act as our ground source of the truth of air pollution concentrations. So actually part of the work that we do at AQEI is building a network of partners who have these kind of disparate and disconnected networks of sensors. So they're often community groups who've invested in one or two sensors in a specific village or in a specific community, with larger governmental networks of data, and basically helping leverage the larger global distribution of sensors. Some are better at measuring air pollution than others, but actually kind of using all of that to basically enable air pollution to be measured everywhere. So we can see where satellites are measuring these types of features from space. And then with our models, we can predict what those actually look like in terms of air pollution on the ground. And so what that does, that allows basically communities that don't have the resources to invest in their own sensors to get kind of sensor-grade measurements. And we've actually been able to kind of classify the air quality index by 75% accuracy across the world at a 1 kilometer level. So the idea is that we think that the first thing you need to do to be able to solve the air pollution crisis is first measure it accurately. And then what we're going to do is partnering with UNICEF and other NGOs alike is start educational campaigns. So we have one going in Belize with the Belizean government and the Belizean UNICEF office there, which actually allows these sensor measurements to be given, or these machine learning derived measurements to be given to school children in Belize. And they end up basically producing diaries, so daily diaries of what the air pollution data was changing, how it was affecting their life, what they would say is a source and a sink of air pollution, and then basically engaging their parents around that as well. So that's one, one instance of a pilot that we've done. We're very excited to talk more about the work that we're planning to do with UNICEF. And then my final comment, we haven't taken on any venture money. The business model isn't set. As Kavi said, it's really hard to find willingness to pay in the communities that we work for, especially for something that's so nascent and, unknown as air pollution. And so, we're trying to engage on a much more broader field, like tapping into climate. Obviously, we have a lot of kind of overlaps and synergies there, but it's been really hard to find air pollution-specific funding opportunities.
Great. I have follow-up questions, but first I'm going to go to Antonella. If you also can explain a little bit what XCapit is doing and what's your experience been. I know that you definitely have funders, so what has that been like?
Thank you, Chris. And first of all, I already knew the projects that you're working on, but listening to it again, it's so inspiring. So thank you for that. And yes, as Chris was saying, we are based in Argentina. Our startup is called XCapit, and we build blockchain solutions. And as he was saying, always focused on impact. We are in love with blockchain. It has so much potential, so many use cases. And we first started with financial inclusion because we found that in Latin America, there are a lot of financial problems. Like 65% of all Latin America doesn't have access to financial services. And actually, this technology could solve it very easily. So we started there. And then we started like 5 years ago when this was quite new. Then we evolved. And right now, we are working on something very exciting. We are using it to help humanitarian institutions to send money to refugees, people in vulnerable solutions that don't have a smartphone, don't have internet. As Kavi was saying, there are many areas, even in Argentina or further, we are studying in Peru, even Turkey. Like, there are many, many people in a situation in which they don't have enough storage in their phones to download a new app. That was like, for us, learning that situations was very important to create this product using blockchain technology. And we are amazed, like, we can really solve this and make a difference for a lot of people that are having a horrible moment in their lives. So that is what makes us wake up every day. And we have gathered a team. Everyone is based in Argentina. And we've raised some money. We had some challenges. First of all, the technology was misunderstood where we were. Or at least maybe we couldn't explain it well. So maybe it's our fault also, obviously. But then there wasn't a lot of liquidity in Argentina. So, of course, we could inspire and get angel investors, but we also got VC or venture capital investments, and it was challenging, but we got it, and we are still understanding how it works. And that's, I think we will talk further through the panel, so I don't want to take a lot of time in this introduction. So thank you.
Great. Yeah, so with UNICEF, now it's Office of Innovation. It's like a big operation. It's based in Stockholm, but it started around 7 years ago as an innovation unit with just six random people scattered around the headquarters in New York. And we tried to build stuff in New York first. And after about 2-3 years, like, we realized just nothing works. It just doesn't make any sense. And so that was the moment when we kind of changed our thinking and we were, okay, we're just gonna let the people who know what the problems are build the solutions themselves. And UNICEF is really well positioned for that because we have probably more country offices than any nation has embassies. We have country offices in 150 countries or something. So we are very well positioned to really be there on the ground. But I see it over and over again that there is this vicious loop of funding the problem solvers from EU, from the States, from Canada, who sometimes they've never been to Sri Lanka or Argentina or India, but they claim to know how bad the air is in New Delhi, how difficult it is to like use your credit card or debit card in Argentina, and then what it really means to be a child and a young person in the educational system in Sri Lanka. So I'm just looking at this graphic. You know, guys, if 5% goes to the emerging and developing markets, where does the 95% go? You've been around. Like, who gets this money?
I have this interesting geographical location dilemma. So I spent 6 months in Palo Alto, which is where our research lab is based off at Stanford, and the remaining time I spend in Sri Lanka and India. When I came to the Valley, my mind was absolutely blown. It was blown off by the genius, the innovation, the research capabilities, but it was blown off by this misplaced priorities that I saw in the Valley. I was just looking at kind of the state of the world right now. If you look at the situation in Gaza, as of March 11, 31,000 people have been killed, 70% of them have been children. If you take the case of Sudan, they're facing the largest conflict-driven famine, people not having food to eat. And the same in Congo, there's 24.5 million people in need of just food assistance. So this is what the world in our side, opposite of the Greenwich Meridian, is facing. Now, if you look at the VC numbers, there was a company called Dream Chaser that's building a satellite, the first ever commercial spaceship for travel. And they raised $1.4 billion very recently. There was a company called Juicero that raised $120 million to make a juice machine. A juice machine, like to make orange juice or whatever type of juice they were trying to make. And there was a company called Quibi that was a short-form video streaming platform, raised like $1.7 billion to declare bankruptcy. So all the companies I mentioned, two of them have declared bankruptcy. So I think for me, if we're unable to sit in this world today and realize that we have a huge issue with where we're putting our money and what our priorities are, we're just completely reinventing the wheel, and COVID has absolutely taught us nothing. And I think that comes from funding people who dealt with the issues that they're trying to solve. We see a lot of edtech companies are based in Palo Alto. They test their tools with kids from some of the richest schools in the world. And then they take it to India and they say, oh, there's no internet. And this is this funding dislocation. And I think that is, for me, one of the biggest issues that is hard to solve, this empathy problem. And I think there's an empathy problem underlying this dislocation. And that's kind of what keeps me up at night. But
you said that there is no internet, but in some places there are not electricity. That's why they choose feature phones or basic phones, because they can go to the market and charge it. And they said the smartphones will take will be like one day, so I don't want a smartphone, so I will keep the feature phone. And that's very important when you're building a solution. And what you were saying, Chris, like I wanted to build on that. If you want to solve a problem, you need people involved in that situation, that geography, who already knows the problems. The solution that we're building right now is based on feature phones, on basic phones. So how can they receive money? Because they are experiencing a very complicated situation financially, so they need that money. They don't have electricity maybe, or internet, data, credit on their smartphones, or they only have an old phone. So it is very important just to gather entrepreneurs from the geographies, and the emerging markets have a huge like opportunity. So it's very important just to look for solutions that are built there. But as you were saying, a few percentage of the capital goes there. So there is a huge potential that is being missed, let's say.
Yeah, one last thing on the you know, how do these like tech first projects translate into on the ground, I guess, intelligence delivery, even though we have these machine learning algorithms that operate on our servers, also in the US, yeah, the way that we deliver those is by, we put different colored flags on schools to say whether air pollution is green equals healthy, orange equals hazardous to go outside, but for extended periods of time, and red is kind of stay inside. Again, there's also this disconnect, especially when we talk to funders in the US, and obviously there's a, you know, a bunch of VC, I call them VC vultures around MIT, who is looking to poach kind of the best-in-class startup, is that when we describe what air pollution is, I mean, you've got to take them through a journey of how bad air pollution can get in areas that we work. So, you know, obviously, Global South countries, including India, where it can be extremely hazardous, especially in the wintertime. But it really is an experiential thing. I mean, maybe actually I think people might be more aware now, considering wildfires in the summer are actually so bad in the US. But if anyone was in New York over the summer and just saw that kind of orange haze that descended on the city over a 12-hour period, like that's what it looks like every day. And it was actually really helpful to get that data point last summer, because we were like, you remember that? Right, that's what it's like every day. So now there was like some level of connection. But there's also this difference, because when we talk about ambient air pollution, which is the air pollution outside versus indoor air pollution, we kind of have to explain they're the same thing, because there's no closed door system. A closed door system is something like this, you know, where you've got like proper ventilation and sealed windows. Like, that often doesn't happen, and it's just so hard for people to get their head around the fact that ambient air pollution is basically the same indoor and outdoor. And so, you know, people always want to make this distinction, but actually there is very little distinction in the parts where we're working. But that was just another comment on that.
I think that's a perfect example, because I was not aware of bad air quality. I know a lot about financial problems. I'm from Argentina. But when Cristina was talking to us, she was explaining how bad it was for health in certain parts of the world, but I never experienced it. And I traveled, I lived in different countries. And I was like, wow, I know very little. So that happens when you are not building this solution in the place where you're living, or you don't know the problem very well. So yeah, that was great.
Three quick follow-ups. VC vultures, I'm stealing this one. And the first day when I was here, there was a session on the young people who should be designing their own digital future for the social media to be safe. And somebody said that now the digital social media is like digital fentanyl. So I love this one. You can steal it. In terms of schools, it's fun fact, we don't even know how many schools there are in the world and where they are. So like, that's the first thing before we even start mapping them and putting the indicators on them. And then third, on the tech side, I was one of the persons that in the past thought that, for instance, VR would be great in the Ghana educational system because I was in New York, and I thought I knew. And then we started working with the Ghanaian entrepreneurs, and we went there, and we learned quite quickly that radio is still by far the best technology to provide education in those countries. I wanted to sort of pick your brains on one thing. So I'm from UNICEF, so we also always look for money. So we're in the same boat here. And Christina, when we were chatting before this, we were talking about the patient capital as like capital, that capital needs patience. I mean, it drives me personally up the wall when, with UNICEF, we have donors, we have governments who require from us, for instance, to deliver on some life-saving KPIs, I would call them, within 1 year of getting a grant, or even within like 6 months. They give you money, they announce it in January with a big, hoopla, like, we're amazing. They give you money by June, and they tell you that you need to spend it by December 31st. Like, that's the world I live in. And then yesterday I was just reading that in 2023, it was for Uber the first year when they actually had profit. That's 15 years in. When was the last time when you were given funding with a 15-year horizon?
I mean, of course never, but I think there's like, it's kind of hard because you're held to different standards. I think coming from working in Global South, like there is a need for having more evidence that your solution can work. And of course, it's maybe you need more evidence for VCs to get kind of a feel for what needs to be done. But at the same time, I can see many different graduates from my school, MIT, who are getting, upwards of $2 million of funding just based on an idea and their CS degree. So, I think, just a really short comment is patient capital needs to enter kind of emerging countries. I think it's pretty non-trivial to say that India is going to be top three global economies in the next 20 years. So missing out on that is something that VCs are opting into now by not actually looking into these markets more and looking at tech being developed on the ground. India has over 100 unicorns at this point. So it's actually not, it's not an unobvious thing to actually go in and invest in these countries. But we just don't see enough capital from Silicon Valley entering them. So, Kavi, I'm curious on your thoughts on this as well.
Yeah, I think we were chatting about this earlier. I think the idea is that there is an economy case here. And I think lots of think tanks have been trying to push this economy case, whether it's climate change, whether it's financial inclusion or education. We are contributing to this ever-increasing middle class in the emerging markets. Secondly, when venture funds diversify and move into emerging markets, we are opening markets to other companies in your portfolio that do not even understand what it's like to do business in our side of the world. How business is done in India, very different to how business is done in Sri Lanka. We are literally divided by like 25 kilometers of like water. But these geographies are extremely different. How business happens in the UAE, very different to how business, for example, happens in Saudi. Like, there are so many cultural factors at play that startups do not understand. But when you bring in founders from emerging markets, we bring that expertise with us. And I think there are so many case studies where, for example, venture philanthropy, where large nonprofits like UNICEF are putting money, venture money, into for-profit companies that are helping their cause. For example, the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation put in, I think, a couple of million dollars into a for-profit research organization that founded one of the first FDA-approved therapeutic cures for cystic fibrosis. And the return was $3.3 billion, which went into a nonprofit foundation. And similar, there are companies like Acumen Fund that do amazing work in funding emerging markets and emerging markets only. So it's not just a feel good, oh, we're giving to the poor kids who don't have electricity story, which is stale and old. There is an economic case here that we're trying to push. And I think for that, you need decision makers in venture funds who understand our markets, because it's tiring to spend like 15 minutes trying to set context and make like John living in his beautiful house in Atherton empathize with kids in Sri Lanka. So I think that needs to change.
Also, when UNICEF were somehow deciding in which startups to invest, it really struck me that they were asking for profit organizations. I thought like, okay, if UNICEF is helping, maybe they are investing only in impact projects. But they were very clear: you need to be sustainable financially. We want to know how you are going to make money, because we're not going to be here forever. So I think that you can make some investments and also expect return, of course, but focus on impact. I had a personal experience. Okay, first of all, when we raise capital, we usually ask venture capitals and angel investors, how do you decide? Like, what's your thoughts? How do you decide between two different startups? And one of them told me, we look for certain things, and one is that you're working for a project with a higher purpose. Why? Because they said they have more chances to stay together through difficult times. And something that you can expect of a startup is to have difficult times, that's for sure. And a few months or some time ago, we ran out of capital because a venture capital was going to invest a lot of money in our startup. And the transfer was delayed. All the papers were signed. We were expecting the transfer to arrive. And after 3 months, they said, we're bankrupt. And it was between Christmas and New Year's. And we were like, we don't have money to pay the salaries in Christmas time. So we were like, should we tell them on the 27th of December? Should we ruin the New Year's? Everyone's New Year's Eve. We were like, what if they're planning their holidays and they're planning a bigger holiday that they can pay? So we decided to tell them, everyone. And we said, look, guys, we don't have money. So we will pay as far as we can in December, but we don't have anyone in the funnel. We already ended the funding run. Yes. So we said, we are inviting you, everyone, to stay and continue building this, but we cannot pay January, February. We will try March, so you can stay for free. If we get money, we'll pay. If not, thank you. We understand if you have bills to pay. That was really difficult because one of their strengths is our team. And we didn't want to lose the best developers, the best people. They're our friends. It's like a family. And the majority stayed, like, with us. We were like, more than 20 people is willing not to get paid? We were like, this is crazy. And we were like, what's happening? Like, why are you staying? And they were like, okay, so they are developers, blockchain developers. They just opened their eyes and they are like hired from anywhere in the world. They're like the most needed skill right now. They said no, because we feel like we are building something here that changes something, like has impact and higher purpose and is helping a lot of people. So they stayed. So that what this venture capital told me, it's kind of true, because for the ventures or the investor that are here in the room, just take that consideration. It might increase the probability of the life of the startup if they are building something with a higher purpose.
Yeah, and there was a thread when we were prepping for this. Somebody said companies die because they don't believe in what they're doing. I think the blessing of being in this space is that we really work with people who do believe in what they're doing. And that's a pretty good segue to, I do want to ask you about the open source and building in the open, because so much of a sentiment and being in the open source space is, you know, these networks and these groups who just want to contribute to the public good, really. And we as UNICEF Venture Fund, the goal for all of our startup is to develop digital public goods. So there's a whole concept of digital public goods. You can, you know, be vetted as a DPG, and then you can basically build your business strategy to become part of a global digital public infrastructure. And so that's one part of how we're trying to support these guys. But if you can give me just a few thoughts on why do you even, I mean, I don't think it makes your life easier.
No, it actually makes it a lot harder. Like building in the open, so we've been part of the, we've been trying to get a DPG through UNICEF. It's been really hard. The reason why it's been hard is because we originally wanted to submit our AI models. So the models that we have that predict air pollution at 1 kilometer level, and then we want to also work with our partners to do 200 meters. So this is very high granular, the highest granular model to predict air pollution concentrations on the ground. It's been really hard. And the reason why is because of open data. So open data is not easily accessible. People like Google Earth Engine host a lot of NASA data, but NASA data is behind a third-party license, which has meant that because we can't kind of showcase that all of the data that we're using is open source, we aren't able to submit our models. So we can't get other UNICEF officers to use the results of our models in their work. So what we've had to do is kind of submit the software through which you can build a model, but then it requires the team that we submit that to have the skills on their side to run the code. And so it's a larger kind of issue that people aren't submitting these data sets in the open. So people like me using third-party licensed data sets find it really difficult to actually share a lot of the code and the models that we build. But that being said, like the Digital Public Good is a really great place for us to showcase our work and the software that we build to help basically collate a lot of that satellite data together in a kind of machine learning readable format, which is, if anyone's ever seen satellite data, it doesn't look like normal data sets. It's big, cubes of images that go through time and they're in horrible file formats. And so we basically try and make that really, really accessible to people who don't have to, don't have to trawl through that type of data, don't have the cloud access that we do. That's one thought on the open source, but it is harder because, we have developers who come in and come out for different periods of time. They can contribute to code that's often quite disparate and we have to clean it up. It's really hard to get standardized software development processes when you're building in the open. But we do it despite that because we want to bring along the community with us. So yeah, we have a bunch of developers who've helped us out on aspects from the security processes with our code, also to the machine learning side and kind of scaling up some of our processes. And we've learned a lot through that. It's always a part of like giving back, I think, to the wider community. And I guess like we see a lot of this debate playing out now in the generative AI space where there's a whole bunch of people opting for closed source models because of, I guess, bias and all of this stuff. But often these problems get they get resolved when you have more collective opinion going into the debate. And if you close source everything, then you can't have that. So that's kind of my 2 cents on that as well.
I think one massive hit for the open source community was what happened with OpenAI. They started as a nonprofit, and they wanted to keep their models open. And then very recently, I think last year or something, they closed it. They went for for-profit. And the big issue is recently that this is like our data. Like this is the data of the public that OpenAI is building on. These are public goods. It's like the electricity or it's like the street lamp that is providing light to anybody who's passing through. These are public goods. Like our data is a public good. And now they're closed. And I think the huge business case, and let me give you an example. So the whole idea of a digital public good is that we're building technology that can be reused by anyone. So for example, in the case of Tilly, we have a model where we're able to capture the emotion of a child, understand their distress levels, and then see what type of self-regulation strategy works best for them. And this model, the design, the language, all of that is open source. So any developer can clone it and build on top of it. They can build a game, another software, et cetera. So this is what it means to make a digital public good. The case for this is there's a huge amount of repetition that happens in the tech world. There might be like 10 different companies literally doing the same thing, wasting important development talent, office space, server space, electricity, everything doing the same thing. So for us, the thing is how do we bring this together and build technology that can be reused? But the problem is, the big question we get from VCs is, like, what's the business case? Like, tomorrow a competitor can literally clone this and reuse it. It's risky to invest in you. So I think what this requires is a reimagination of how we do business and what matters and what we prioritize. So it's been hard to build in open source, but.
I have a quick comment on if it is open source, where is the business? Like, try to build a startup just with the technology. Like, you miss the 50% or more of the partnerships, business, creating a team. Like, it's quite difficult to make a company, even if you get the exact product or development. So just to keep that in mind. We have open source in our DNA because we work with blockchain projects, and the speed that blockchain is being developed is increasingly high because it's open and the majority of the projects are open, so you can build on top of the other. In fact, what we are developing right now, we said we don't have time to develop this, so let's grab whatever it already exists that is really good. Let's put everything together. Let's pilot this in 6 months in Turkey, for example. And if it works and everything goes well, let's start developing whatever we need. So this is a good strategy to move fast in a very changing environment. And I was talking recently during this event with one developer that he says, I'm contributing to open source projects. So I was like, wow. My background is I study and worked in civil engineering for 10 years. And then I worked in Deloitte, at corporate finance, M&As. So when I heard that open source developers don't charge for their work, I was like, why? Like, why would you? I couldn't work him for free. Like, so I asked him, why are you contributing? This was new for me. Maybe in the industry it was very well known. And he was like, sometimes I need a feature. Sometimes I need to fix something. And I just grab it and fix it, and then it's for everyone. So it has some use for myself. Also, I'm building my reputation. And I tried in the past to ask for non-open source projects to fix something for me because I was using it, and it's a nightmare. Like, forget it. You have to contact this and that, and you cannot convince them. So I don't even use those projects. So the powerful and it's very powerful, and the potential of open source projects is huge because people are willing to contribute, also if they're aligned with their priorities and their values, and everyone is invited. And what you can say to the VCs that tells you that is like, when you're solving a global problem, you need all the minds and hands available. And the cake is huge. So it's not like because I'm building open source, all the competitors are going to take my market. The market is huge. So the cake is huge.
That must have been a shock. It must be a shock to the Deloitte person that you can work for free. I was listening to the congressional hearing yesterday from the four consultancies, like about their work in China, and like selling all the secrets, and yeah. Interoperability, that's so for UNICEF, it is crucial. The idea behind digital public goods is that this is open source, so you can localize it very quickly. This is such a challenge and problem for us that you have, platforms that try to solve the same thing over and over again, built from the scratch. So the idea is that doesn't happen. And then, the maintenance and the costs. If we have a Silicon Valley company developing an educational platform for Sierra Leone, more often than not, they will lock the government in some kind of way. In the contract, and if you need additional maintenance, add the functionality, remove functionality, you basically are being sabotaged by the big tech. And so the moment where we build local capacity on the ground that can maintain, design, and own those tech platforms, that's the way to go. As we have 15 minutes left, and you guys are warmed up, I have a difficult question. I have no idea what the answer is. And maybe then some Q&A if folks want to engage the difficult question. And I don't know the answer. So for me, the world of VC is synonymous with very aggressive financial returns, okay? So I would guess their instinct is to follow opportunity, which would mean you just hang out in the very developed markets. Yet the world of global crises is synonymous with aggressive social impact returns. So that means we're thinking about really deprived markets where potentially there is little opportunity for very quick financial gain. So it's like almost an existential tension. And maybe that's why this pool in the global south is very, very small. So first of all, do you see that? How does one reconcile that? And do you even agree with that thesis?
I love how this looks at me. I think I'm reminded of this quote by one of my favorite authors, Arundhati Roy. She says, a new world is not only here, she's possible, and on a quiet day, I can hear her breathe. And I think for me, it's this idea of hope. I think the scariest thing that happens to people in our space of impact is losing hope, because it's so easy to lose hope. And I think for me, it's this hope in a different way of seeing the world, a different set of priorities. And I think there are sort of these three things. One is, you mentioned this, changing this checklist of what a successful entrepreneur is and what success means. For me, I had to do a lot of self-reflection of what does growth and scaling mean to me. What growth and scaling means to me now is a small team, a healthy runway, a process of building that's joyful, and hours that are manageable, and growth that is high quality, so that every step of the way we know we're making learning outcome changes for children. That is what growth means to me, not hitting 1 billion learners by 2027. Because that comes at the risk of losing quality. And I think the second thing is having funds from emerging markets, having decision makers in VC funds who have been and lived in communities like us and understand these issues, who can make decisions, not just these advisors that VC funds have from emerging markets that don't have any stake. And the third thing is things like building in the open source, like changing the way we design technology and who gets to use it. But I think that needs that act of just reimagining what is possible and having hope in that possibility. That's what I would say. But just.
I can go. Mine's more depressing than that, to be honest.
The healthy balance, though. So.
Yeah, it's okay. I mean, one thing that I've been thinking about recently is the fact that some of the work that we do, which is primarily focused on environmental health, is often construed under the big umbrella of climate change funding. And we do it ourselves. Like, we do ourselves a disservice by kind of branding ourselves as a climate change kind of startup. And we often actually get asked, oh, can you just do your models but predict CO2? Because we get, like, carbon credits for that, or there's carbon tax breaks for that. And I love the fact that there's so much work going into climate change initiatives. But there is a point at which sometimes air pollution is categorically disaligned with climate change efforts. And one example is this, so bear with me. I don't know if anyone knew, but over the last year, there's been an initiative to take out sulfur dioxide from shipping fuel. So that's kind of a byproduct of shipping fuel. And this actually reduces warming, because of the sulfur dioxide that's released is a reflectivity component in the atmosphere. So it increases the reflectance of the planet. Obviously, the shipping lanes are done at scale. You know, there's many different global tankers going across every day. So this has actually a kind of large global impact on the temperature, global warming. So this year it was removed, and actually we saw accelerated temperature rises. Now, sulfur dioxide is an air pollutant. And so actually what we see is, you know, air pollution can reduce the impact of climate change. And so it's really hard, because scientists know that, but often VCs are like, well, you know, they're kind of the same thing. And another example of where we've been doing a lot of work is on oil and gas pollution. So these things called flares, which are natural gas kind of being burnt in the atmosphere. Now, when it's burnt, it can release anything from particulate matter, black carbon, all the way up to very fine granular particulates. But we noticed this year that the World Bank had actually changed one of their initiatives, which was originally called the Zero Flaring Initiative, to the Global Methane Reduction Pledge. And now the change of the language is one thing, but the prioritization of reducing flaring versus reducing methane was actually flipped. And reducing the flaring is the thing that causes the air pollution, whereas reducing methane can often be actually continuing with flaring, which is the thing that harms our lungs. So we're seeing like these kind of things emerge where climate and air pollution have been put in the same bucket, but actually often treating them as the same can be very damaging. And so there's places where they work together, and you know, black carbon is one of those. So reducing black carbon reduces soot in children's lungs, but also reduces the climate impact. But the thing like sulfur dioxide, then that's actually where they two decouple. So I'm trying to make that delineation, because often climate funds are, you know, what the thing that gets the most attention, but yeah, environmental health outcomes are often seen at the detriment of that. And so, yeah, that's something that's coming online more. So yeah, sorry for that downer, Chris.
I will add some hope now. there is a great dislocation. We can agree all, we all can agree on that. We have certain countries in which there are more liquidity, let's say, of capital. So it's easier to make businesses in some places than in others. But from an investor's perspective, knowing my background, I could say that if I were investing, I would definitely check on emerging markets for three reasons. First, we know it's risky. So in every diversification of investment, it's good to have a percentage in emerging markets. And it is risky because many things that we already know, but there are like two ways that you can minimize the risk. One is like partnering with someone local who can tell you what about the rules, how it works, so you can even invest in those markets. And the other one is starting with a small capital. Like our first VC is from Canada. He invested a small amount, tried us out, mentored us several months, looked how we grow, and then he invested much more, like 10 times more. So that could be a strategy. But the second thing is like the huge opportunity, the big market. When I was telling you about the financial inclusion, there are like 65% of Latin America didn't have financial services. We are talking about 450 million people. So it's a huge market. And now we are developing this solution for institutions to send money, cash transfers to refugees, people in distress. We are talking about almost 4 billion that are sent or has been sent last year. So just imagine a percentage of that going to revenue. So it could be huge, like very profitable. And the third would be the knowledge of the market. It's, you need people that lives there to understand deeply and not just to come up with a pilot and then failing in the first attempt. So if I were an investor, I will check definitely the emerging markets.
Trying to put all of this in one sentence, impossible. But I think that what I'm taking out of this is that helping is hard. It's really, really, really hard. And so it's not only complicated, it's more complex than complicated, especially when it comes to tech. And so, yeah, I think that if the investors and supporters could just give a longer runway to the ones that they want to support, but also much longer runway and time to themselves, just to understand the contexts. I don't think you can understand it during like a 5-minute pitch. Then maybe we will have more joyful tech companies like Kavis that don't have infinite growth as their main North Star, which probably would do all of us a lot of good in the tech space. So with that, a huge thank you to all of you, all three of you, and there is a mic. It looks like people will be singing. I feel like I'm an American Idol judge.
Yeah, there's already a line. It's good.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much. That was really interesting. All your projects are incredible. So my name's Ariana. I run the UK's leading music-led mental health movement. We bake mental health tools into music and lyricism, working with the world's best musicians. We make it accessible to communities who are not typically accessible. So I completely agree with all of you. The VC funding model is deeply corrupted. It is actually, I don't believe it is going to serve solving some of these wicked problems we're all trying to serve. We've got something in the UK called the Better Business Act, and I don't know if you've heard of it yet. So it's an act that's trying to make it legally required to bake your impact goals, your environmental goals, into your legal framework, your articles of association, firstly. And it means that your shareholders can't sort of corner you further down the line and make you put profit over impact. And I personally think that is, I think no matter what we do on our level of entrepreneurship and innovation, it's going to make a difference until we see some legislative change that makes VC change their model. Because the way it is with this deeply capitalist framework for VC, and that is VC ultimately, I don't think we're actually going to solve the problems we need to solve, and I don't think the funding's going to change. Have you seen any legislations that have helped your projects? And yeah, I'd love to know kind of from your experience what you've seen in that realm.
I can comment that when you're working with impact, we received a lot of funding from governments, for example, mm-hmm. or financial or institutions like UNICEF, or there are many in the world that are focusing on impact or certain KPIs that are not the ones that a regular VC will focus on. And that's very important for us. It has been a game changer. Like, we raised like $1 million or more from private equity and $1 million with grants, like something like that. Mm-hmm. And also I think that to change, there must be some benefit. They are not gonna do it just because it's good. They need some benefit. So what I've seen is that certain companies that we worked with and certain institutions, they receive cheaper financing, something like the states or bigger organizations says, okay, if you are investing in impactful startups, I can give you a loan with a smaller interest rate, something like that. So we might find something like that.
Mm. Yeah, I'm just going to jump in. Like, the thing that I really despise is just dishonesty, and I think just, you know, business should be honest. Like, okay, you're there to make money. Just admit that you're there to make money, and that's it, you know? And just, like, support those that, like, have different North Stars. And can we just stop this unnecessary conversation? Mm-hmm. So I don't have much hope or, I don't know, I don't think there's, like, need to try to change the corrupted sort of, you know, all of these developed markets. Mm-hmm. But I can tell you that there's a lot of really interesting legislation happening in, for instance, in Africa, where I did spend some time. And, you know, there is interesting legislation, for instance, to support startups, entrepreneurs, and, you know, social impact tech entrepreneurs. And so I think if we can shift even the governments of the global north, if they can shift their support towards supporting legislation in those countries, you know, to have the startups not spend 18 months to start a business, but 3 months, and they can go to like the single window, and it's kind of, you know, just this whole network of support is better, then I think that will have a bigger impact than trying to change what's, I think, unchangeable. Yeah.
That's really helpful, thank you.
Yeah.
I just want to leave on saying, Kavi, thank you for wearing the kufiya. I really appreciate it. I don't know if... I'm sure we're all very conscious people in this room, and we know that South By has accepted money from people who profit from war. We need to hold institutions ethically accountable, and we need to make sure they don't do it again next year.
Thank you for that. Also, I know it's super uncomfortable to see you standing. I promise we will speak to all of you. I think we have 1 minute left. So just maybe quick question. And if they just will kick us out, then we are here and we'll talk. Okay? Please. Yeah.
My name is Victor Rogers. So quick question. In the venture capital ecosystem, while substantial investment towards the flow of ambitious projects like space exploration and advanced tech startups are vast, organizations such as the Fearless Fund, committed to empowering Black women, represent a small, minute amount of that venture, and they're currently in legal challenges against organizations like the American Alliance for Equal Rights. My question is, how can the VC industry better balance its pursuit of technical frontiers with the imperative necessity to foster social equality for organizations like the Fearless Fund? And I use ChatGPT to make this, and it sounds like way too bad. So I guess from a high level, the Fearless Fund...
Lesson learned.
Yeah. The Fearless Fund is an organization that I've been researching, and I don't like that they're in court and they're just trying to give money to Black women, and they only represent 0.4% of venture capital in America. I want to put my foot on the neck of the people who are trying to take money from them, and yeah, make me a weapon to do that.
So I think we have to get off the stage. We have to get off the stage. Okay.
I'm sorry, guys.
So we're going to come up to you, and we're going to chat about it. Guys, thank you so much for spending time with us. Thank you.